Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to Smarty Pants, the podcast of the American Scholar magazine, sponsored by Phi Beta Kappa. I'm your host, Stephanie Bastick. As an artist and activist, Betty Yu has spent her career focusing on the community around her, Sunset Park, Brooklyn, where she was born and raised. Whether it was as a member of the Chinatown Arts Brigade, engaging art galleries on their role in gentrification, or projecting tenants' life stories on the sides of buildings slated for redevelopment, Yu's work has stressed the connection between art and social change. But what happens when COVID-19 makes interacting with your neighbors life-threatening? Betty Yu, who first began turning the camera on her parents' family life in 2019, joins us on the podcast to talk about getting even more personal during the pandemic. Thanks so much for talking to me, Betty.
Of course. Happy to be here.
So I wanted to start by talking about the photograph we ran in our last issue, which is called Dad, Still, Quiet, and Daydreaming. And what struck me most about it is that it was taken before the pandemic, but it conveys such a strong sense of social isolation already. We have a link to it in the show notes, but for listeners who haven't had a chance to look at it yet, it is a photograph of your dad sitting on his bed with his back to the camera, staring out the window with this kind of soft sepia light coming into the room. So what were you trying to convey with this photograph?
It's interesting. A lot of the photos I've taken of my dad have very much been in isolation. And my mother, too. And they live in the same small apartment in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. But I really wanted to capture the psychological isolation as well as the physical isolation. In many ways, I would say that my parents have been socially isolating from each other for like over 30 years, and they've been together for about 50. But I say that because I think a lot of the isolation they felt from each other and from society really has a lot to do with the economics. So they both were like garment workers working really long hours and retired recently. And my dad, particularly, who is in his early 80s now, he would tell all of us, like, I can't wait till the day I can just literally sit still and not have to, you know, rush to work at, you know, 8 a.m. and work 15 hours and then come back and then start over again. And I didn't quite understand why, you know, as a younger person, when he would tell us this, you know, we all thought that, he would want to, you know, I mean, we grew up pretty low income working class, but that he would want to travel locally or, do some other things or socialize. And I realized that what capitalism does, right, what like working in a garment sweatshop does is that it does create this social alienation, this kind of alienation from others. He was working as a button operator, so he's partially deaf now because for 30 years he was like constantly putting buttons on, on clothing and on pants and things. And so it was very loud. They don't have any protective gear. And so looking back, I'm realizing he didn't really make a lot of friends because the boss was right there breathing down your neck. So you really couldn't socialize. And so years later, and I see him, and I literally, anytime I go visit my parents, and as of late, not as much because of COVID, that is the position he's in. He's sitting on the bed looking out. You know, he was just like, this is my most comfortable and position and I'm at peace. And this is what I was longing for. He's like, I told you guys, I was waiting for this moment where I could sit still, read a newspaper, drink my coffee, maybe take a walk down the block. And I think that that captures a lot of what we're all feeling right now, especially at the beginning of COVID. I'm like, huh, that was like me, you know, for a while when I was like inside looking out my window, making no contact. And so my dad had already been doing that for a really long time from my mom, from society. But there's also massive gentrification happening in the neighborhood that I grew up in. And they don't know if they're going to be able to stay in this house. And since they've been retired, obviously, they're on fixed incomes. And like I said, you know, they work, their wages weren't very high to begin with. So their social security is not a lot. And so there's a real threat of displacement because condos are literally going up on their block. Real estate value and all this has like quadrupled or even more over the last couple of years. And so that photo is a part of a larger series of how gentrification is impacting me personally and my family personally.
Has the course of the project Displaced in Sunset Park changed as a result of the pandemic? I mean, it seems like your dad's practice hasn't really changed at all, but I imagine yours might have as an artist.
Yeah, exactly. My dad, it's funny, my dad's life is like, he's like, oh, this is what I've been doing since he's retired like over 10 years ago. So yeah, my practice has changed a lot. My work is very, very much community-based. And in this, it's very special to me, this aspect of the larger project called Displaced in Sunset Park, because it's a sort of a photographic kind of personal diary, starting with my parents' block and all the condos that are going up. And then the pandemic hit. And so it really threw me for a loop, because what I was going to do was talk to community members, small business owners, workers and teachers and folks who from different angles looking at gentrification in the Latinx and the Chinatown, Chinese part. And many of the people gentrifying the neighborhood look like me. They're Chinese developers from China as well as domestic developers. But anyway, it all changed literally overnight, and my mom became the photographer quite literally. I didn't know what would become of the project, but I had to shift it very quickly. So I figured, okay, I'm going to create this interactive experience. And so you get to see what the pandemic is like through my parents' eyes, who are both elder and in one of the epicenters of New York City in terms of the pandemic. And so she would go really early in the morning for walks and take photos. And it was very hard because I literally didn't see my parents for 6 or 7 months, I think. And the first time I saw them, I wanted to hug them. We were out in the park, but even then we couldn't really interact. And for that 6 months, it was all FaceTime. Luckily, I had a whole archive of photographs from my grandfather, who was actually an amateur photographer. He was actually a labor organizer in Chinatown. I found out all of this really pretty much like in the last 10 years, and he had died in the 80s. And I was so fascinated with it. I said, there's no better time than now to look back at those archives, because I have nothing else better to do. So I started really like investigating the archive. And, you know, he was one of the founders of the first Chinese labor organization that existed that started in 1934 of hand laundry workers. And of course, the hand laundry business was the only business really that Chinese folks could work in because of the Chinese Exclusion Act, right? And there was all this discrimination. So they couldn't really do much. And so he was actually one who's like the rabble rouser, organizing workers. And so I started to put all this together and realizing that the discrimination and the xenophobia that Chinese faced over 100 years ago, 140 years ago, is very similar to the xenophobia now against Chinese Americans or Chinese, right? Saying slurs in my face, right? Because the way I look, right? Especially early on during the pandemic. And these Chinatowns that were already really hit hard are struggling, and businesses have shut down and all this stuff. So anyway, I started to create this immersive interactive experience through my mom's photographs, through my own archival research, and connecting the present to the past, and actually drawing the very similar connections to migration, to xenophobia. It helped me get a little bit more personal and come full circle with a lot of the trauma I think a lot of immigrants face, where, I was born here, but my family in particular has been in the United States for 4 generations, but they couldn't actually stay here consistently because of rampant discrimination. They had to go back to China, and then, you know, another round of people come. And so there's trauma attached, but there's also a sense of resiliency attached to that, to seeing the through line of my family's narrative, which is very representative of other immigrant experiences in this country. So I would say that I've tried to use the time of isolation to really look inward, because I often didn't do that. It was, a lot of my work has been very like outwardly facing in the community. So it was a good opportunity to check in with myself, I guess.
Yeah, it makes sense that it would be difficult to balance telling your personal story with the stories of all of these other people in the community, especially when something like displacement or gentrification is such a contradictory phenomenon, right? Because it's so individual and so personal, but it rarely happens in isolation. So it's also collective. Can you talk about your work addressing gentrification with the Chinatown Arts Brigade, especially your collaboration with the Chinatown Tenants Union?
Yeah, no, thank you for asking me about Chinatown Art Brigade. That particular collective, when we founded it in 2015, the two other co-founders, Tamia Arai and Mansi Kong, have been involved in various, on various levels with CAB, Chinatown Tenants Union, on various aspects of their work, whether it was the racial justice work, different aspects. And they had come to a point, the CTU, Chinatown Tenants Union, has been around since 9/11. After 9/11, they formed to fight the massive evictions that were happening because, as you know, Chinatown is, you know, 15 blocks away from Ground Zero. And so that gave real estate developers a chance to really gentrify and displace people out of that area. And so they were, Chinatown tenants were facing evictions, so they formed. But anyway, in 2015, they reached out to us and said, you know, we know what we're good at, right? Like canvassing and organizing and door knocking and all this kind of, you know, grassroots organizing. But we really want to, you know, collaborate with artists, community-based artists who can help elevate the stories and highlight not just the resilience, but the resistance. And oftentimes what we see out there is like sort of passive victims, whether it's working conditions or living conditions, but that people are actually fighting back. And so we collaborated with them on their ask, or they approached us, and we formed this collective. We had no idea how amazing the response would be from the community as well as outside the community. And we wanted to also, as artists, challenge other artists who are often the vanguard of displacement in certain neighborhoods in New York City and probably throughout cities in the U.S., where artists, even small artist institutions, are used often by real estate developers to pit them against longtime residents and then increase of police violence against the longtime residents. So we wanted to raise the eyebrows of art galleries who felt like they were on the defense. So like 120 art galleries at that time in 2016 all replaced these small mom and pop places in Chinatown, like bakeries and restaurants and all these small businesses that I grew up loving. We, you know, started to connect the dots and said, you know, you all have a responsibility too, right? It's the big developers, but you are also the Trojan horse, right? You're the one that raises the real estate value, brings the hipster businesses and restaurants and bars and stuff. And actually, a group of them started their own group called Art Against Displacement a year later after that in 2017, which was amazing. It's a mighty small group. And then, of course, we were doing projections. We did a number of workshops with Chinatown tenants. We did walks, cultural production exercises, right? Placekeeping walks, where from all of that, the storytelling project, basically what became of it were images and videos that we projected at night. And the idea was to reach not only the gentrifiers, but really to reach out to tenants, to let them know about their rights and that they can join and there's an organization here. And I think that that became so much more vital. Of course, now you fast forward to COVID and the massive evictions that are happening. Even now with the moratorium in the Chinatowns in Brooklyn and Queens and in Manhattan, there's a huge underground housing economy. In other words, you have these vicious, unscrupulous landlords who are renting out to one person, and then they know in order for that one person to pay the $3,000, they have to partition out a room to someone else, and then they sublease it to someone else, so on and so forth. So they're living in cramped conditions, and oftentimes they're frontline workers, they are essential workers, and a lot of them are A, getting sick very fast, and then B, a lot of them don't qualify for relief aid, and they're not on the lease, right? So, the evictions are still happening, and also a lot of folks can afford not to pay because they're so in such fragile conditions, meaning they're not protected by the sort of moratorium and all these things. If they don't pay their $700 a month, they're not going to stay in that room, which doesn't seem like a lot to us maybe, but it's a whole lot of money for people who are unemployed right now. So it's really, really, really precarious right now. There are a number of buildings in Chinatown that have gone on rent strike pre-COVID, the conditions were pretty bad in a lot of these tenement buildings. If anything, they've gotten worse. And then folks have lost their jobs and things. So there are a number of places that are on rent strike. And one of the buildings, 85 Bowery, has been on rent strike since May 1st. And we've been supporting them and elevating the stories. But that it won't save us alone, right? It has to be part of a larger organizing strategy, a larger movement.
That connection between art and community, art and activism, is a long and storied one. But it isn't necessarily what appeals to people when they go to art school or, you know, who want to make it in the commercial art world will focus on. So how did that connection form for you?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I started up as an activist in high school. This isn't many years ago. I'm going to date myself. In the mid-90s, I was actually studying photography in high school at Edward R. Murrow, which is a wonderful kind of somewhat an alternative type communication school. It's a public school. So I was studying photography, and at the same time, my older sister was getting involved in Chinatown activism. And to be honest, as a 16-year-old, in my mind, I never thought Chinese folks were, you know, had a bone of resistance in their body. We were always told or taught, you know, we're passive, we're docile, we just do whatever we're told and that kind of thing. And so when she first invited me out she was in college at the time, to a protest, I was super shocked. I thought I would see a bunch of white hippie activists, but there were people that looked like me, families, older people from the community, garment, restaurant workers at the time, who were protesting a restaurant that was paying their workers 75 cents an hour and stealing their tips. And it just woke me up to this injustice that was so widespread in Chinatown. And oftentimes, like, it's in plain sight, right? Their world is in plain sight, like right in our own backyard in Chinatown. And so I got really involved in activism and organizing. My parents were garment workers. They were not making minimum wage, working long hours, even in the union shops. So it really infuriated me. It was very personal to me. My parents were working such long hours, and me and my sisters were really robbed of time with our parents because they had to work such long hours to put food on the table. So I got really involved with activism and continued to photograph. And then I went to college for photography, actually, to NYU, and then switched to film and video. So I was very inspired. And then after college, I kind of left all the arts and media stuff for a little while. I was doing direct organizing for a couple of years, and then realizing that my role is actually helping to use art and culture as a form of resistance to highlight and elevate stories of people who are on the front lines fighting for better living and working conditions. And so I went back to school and got my MFA, and, you know, now working on a lot, you know, projects on my own and staying involved in the community. But I have to say that it's come a lot more full circle, more personal for me since with COVID, like I said, I had that time to really look deeper within myself and my personal story and how I'm sort of connected to a lot of these struggles.
I think it's interesting that you say that, because your parents have been a part of your work for a long time, for decades, starting in high school, which I think is a lot earlier than most of us realize. And it's certainly earlier than I realized that our parents have rich and interesting lives outside of our own teenage identities. So it strikes me that you have been addressing your family kind of all along, but I wonder, how have you seen your perspective on your parents shift since you first started documenting their lives?
Yeah, I have been documenting my parents for, sometimes I didn't know what I was doing. I was just documenting for the sake of it, because it's just like, they're your family. You're just, when you're a teenager, you don't understand why you're interested. Then later on, you're like, oh, that's why I'm interested in all these intersections. But I've seen them change over the years, obviously, as they get older and they become more fragile health-wise, physically. But I also think that there's a point, maybe, and I have to be honest, that there was a point in the 90s, or, you know, when, again, you know, and I say this because it's I'm very open about it. Their companionship, or their relationship, was an arranged one. So they, this is very common, and, you know, it happened really fast. And, you know, in the patriarchal society, Hong Kong and China, woman has to reproduce. So my mom got pregnant very young and, you know, had a bunch of kids. And so she never really had an opportunity, and then she had to work right when she got to the States. So she never really had a chance of that sort of like real sort of liberation, right? She was like always, you know, the person who worked way harder than my dad, like working long hours in factory, coming home and feeding the kids and cleaning and all that stuff, you know, double duty, the double exploitation of women. They were very alienated from each other and from us even growing up. But I would say more recently, obviously since they've retired, even though they say they still can't stand each other and, you know, like I told you, they've been socially distanced already for a long time, they have had to spend a lot of time together. My mom, her escape was often going to all my sister's houses to take care of the grandchildren, see the grandchildren. And she can't do that because of COVID. So it's really weird because I see the two of them and my dad's health is declining. My mother is actually becoming more energetic in a way and she wants to get out of the house all the time. Like I would call them through FaceTime and I would see their interaction with each other. Their bantering was different. I can't explain it. No longer could they escape each other in the way that they were before. They have to depend on each other and they're intertwined in many ways that they ordinarily would be able to kind of just kind of be in their own little respective corners. You know, so there's that piece of it. But I also think that there is a deeper appreciation for one another that wasn't there for sure. They won't say it ever, but as they got older, I think they've become a little more fond of each other.
Has the experience of filming your parents changed your relationship with them? Do you feel like they're more open with you as a result of all of that tape?
Definitely. Definitely. I think they are a lot more open and also a lot more honest with me. I think at the beginning, you know, I think they would say the things that they thought they should say on camera. And more recently, maybe because as I get older and as they get older, you know, I'm like, well, it's okay to show conflicts. It's okay to show, you know, it's a whole thing in the Chinese culture of like saving face. And maybe that's every culture, but saving face and like that honor and integrity is like a huge thing. And that to them represents, you don't cry, you don't show emotion, you're stoic. And I encourage them. I'm like, you know, in these interviews or when I photograph you all, when you talk and I'm filming, like, I just want that raw. I want to capture that rawness. And they've been very open. And I'm super shocked when I put something out. I check in with them beforehand. And they're okay with it. And maybe because they're older, they're just like, whatever. But I also explain to them that it's also part of my healing process. Because there's so many emotions that I have in me. Like, you know, not having my parents around when I was growing up. And, you know, all these things. That now I have some tools to be able to understand that and to honor my parents and all the hard work they put in to put us through school and coming full circle. I really want to honor them in a way where I can also communicate to folks who are viewing this work that it's not just my story. It's not unique. It's a story of a lot of immigrants who are first generation, who are stuck in between these worlds. You know, and maybe to reach out to them so that maybe they can relate to the project and relate to the stories. And for me, it's really about making that stuff universal and helping people break out of their own isolation. Cause I often felt like I was very alone. Even though I was told that not alone, that other people are facing these similar conditions. But what I would see out there was the struggling immigrant, or I would see people like me just climbing the corporate ladder and like trying to get away from the community as much as they could. And for me, I am not a Chinese immigrant like my parents were, but I was this educated Chinese American woman who wanted to use the arts and culture actually to give back to my community, to elevate what was happening and use it as a form of resistance. And so I hope in some way I'm able to project that and put that out there to other Chinese Americans, to other children of immigrants, perhaps, to challenge that. And also my parents who, you know, they've been a lot more supportive. You know, I tell them when I have shows and it's in the Chinese newspaper. One time they caught a news story on Chinese TV about my work and they've become proud of me. And at first, when I told them I was an artist like years ago, they're like, what is that? What are you doing? I don't understand what you're doing. And then so for some weird reason, they started to acknowledge and recognize that work. And my mom actually, I was like crying when she first said to me, she's like, I'm actually proud of you. You know, I understand what you're doing. Like maybe like 5 years ago, she's like, I'm really proud of you. I understand what you're doing. Like I didn't for a while, but I get it. And I see you, I recognize you. And like a grown ass woman, you know, just getting emotional. And I don't even think I told my mom this, but I did cry. You know, for me, in a way, it's to pay homage to them and our ancestors for all that they've done too. You know, blood or Chinese or other folks of color or other people who carry on this work.
We have links in the show notes to Betty Yu's work, including the photograph from Displaced in Sunset Park that we ran in our last issue, and also that documentary project that she was alluding to with her grandfather called Intimate/Distant. We'll be back next week. Till then, take care and stay sharp.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.